So we're moving on now from depression, which is the experience of loss, to talk about the phenomenon of anxiety, fear, which of course is the anticipation of loss and threat. And we're going to be talking about very similar structure to depression. So I'm going to speak with a doctor's hat on, just to give a perspective on how professionals, whether they be doctors or psychiatrists, tend to think about these issues so that you know the way they're looking at it and can, you know, relate to that. And then Richard's similarly then going to pick up and recast that picture within a clearer biblical framework. And that's the model once again. So today we do the more secular approach. So we know what's going on in the world. And just recapping on what we said yesterday, is everyone okay? Can you see it? All right, can you see it okay? Yeah? Sorry, I thought you meant you couldn't see it. Is it all right? Am I in the right place? Yeah? Okay. What we don't want to be doing, and you hear some people say this, how do I relate my faith to my secular work, you see? And this is just building even further on what Richard was saying earlier. Or how do I integrate my faith with these secular models? And I think that's a model we want to avoid. That the question is, how do I integrate these secular models and observations within the Christian worldview? And that's the model that we're using here. So that it's not as if there are two things on a par with one another that we're trying to see how we fit them together. It's not integrating in that sense. It's integrating within or building on the foundation of our basic Christian worldview. So let's look at anxiety now. And anxiety is a natural response to feeling threatened or unsafe. And once again, just to remind, all these slides are, or will be this afternoon, up there on glynharrison.com. It's very humbly called glynharrison.com. So it's a natural response to feeling threatened. Oh, depression's up there now, by the way. So, what's interesting about this response is that it's processed in a more primitive, older parts of the brain that share a great deal with animal brains. So in evolutionary terms, people would say that the anxiety is processed in some of the oldest bits of the brain within the evolutionary model. You don't have to buy that model if you don't like it. You can simply say that anxiety is processed in a more primitive part of the brain that's very similar to the way animals process these things in their brains. The experience is vigilance, which is a state of hyper arousal. That's a state of heightened awareness of our environment. It's a broadening out of the lens is made wider in terms of my awareness and vigilance to what might be going on when I'm anxious. That's because my brain is looking after me. It's saying the world is a dangerous place. We are now in a situation of potential threat. That threat can come from anywhere, from behind you, from the side, from the front. We need to widen our lens, ideally to a 360 degree lens, from this specific fear, from this specific focus, to widen it out so that we have maximum vigilance and awareness of where that threat might come from. With that goes a subjective sense of fear and anticipation and tension, which is about, again, our brains organizing our whole bodily response to be ready to respond to the threat. And this is why people who are in chronic states of arousal and fear, if there's a sudden stimulus, they will have what's called a startle response, and they will respond, you see. So somebody here who's anxious at the moment, if I suddenly clap my hand, you may well jump there, because your brain's in 360 degree mode. It's scanning the environment for potential threat, and suddenly something came in that could be just what it's looking for. And so because your muscles are already tenser than usual, and because you're in this state of readiness to respond, you overreact to what was just a clap, and then you fall back to that level of heightened awareness. And this is what makes chronic states of anxiety so tiring, because our muscles are in a constant state of readiness. Our brains are working overtime in 360 degree mode, vigilant to potential sources of threat. So tiring. And that's what, you know, makes tiredness part of this. And also irritability, because you can only keep this up for so long, and we only have so much capacity to cope with unexpected challenge. So I've had a busy day, let's say, I'm anxious, I've had a lot to deal with. I'm now going to fatigue mode. My resources now for responding to new challenges have been diminishing all day, you see. And I walk into the house, my wife says, "Thank goodness you're home," puts the baby in your hand. And that's normally with no problem, because you love your baby, but today you don't have the resources when it suddenly starts crying. And so you snap and you give her back, don't you know what kind of a day I've had, and you storm out the house. And she thinks, wow, what's happened? We've done nothing different, except that because I've been in this state of heightened arousal today, I have no capacity, no reserves of tolerance for unexpected challenge. I've used it all up. So we're beginning to get a feel for what it's like to be anxious, to what you know this phenomenon is. And as we've said, the emotional brain, where these issues are basically processed, is this bit here, what's called the limbic system. And the key bit is the hypothalamus here. And it's deeper down in the brain, you see. And it's in the middle of the brain. And the hypothalamus processes emotions and has lots and lots of connections with the cortex here. And the cortex is the most sophisticated part of the brain that deals with thought. And the emotional brain is basically reacting on the basis of past experience. Okay, so you're walking through the bush, a lion jumps out on you. The emotional brain has learned that the world's a dangerous place. So next time you walk through the bush, you go into 360 degree mode, you go into hyper arousal, you pump out adrenaline so that your muscles are ready to run. And this is the classic fight, flight, or fright response, which adrenaline does for us as the signals are sent to other adrenaline-releasing parts of the body. So the emotional brain is built out of past experience. The way it works is sensitive to past experience. But what it does with its connections with the intellectual brain is it psychs us up in a much more forward-looking sense to anticipate all these possible sources of danger in a more sophisticated way. Because we're thinking creatures, we can work out that if you're going through the bush and last time it was a lion that jumped out on you, maybe there are other animals around here which are just as dangerous. Now, you've got to have intellectual capacity to do that, you see. And so there's an interesting dance between the more primitive processing of emotion and the way we begin to cognitively process that past experience. So maybe there are other animals. Indeed, there are other animals around here. There are a lot of other animals out here. The likelihood of my getting jumped on is really quite large if I think about it. And you can see processes of, you know, cognitive catastrophizing begin to kick into place as our intellectual brain mishandles some of that basic information. So there's an interesting dance goes on between the forward-looking part of the brain, which is anticipating, scanning. The forward-looking part of the brain wants to do a really good job for us, you see. It wants to tell us that, yeah, there are lions, but also tigers. And there are also hyenas. You haven't seen a hyena, I know, but your mother told you about it. They look like this. You can represent it in your mind. So it's an interesting alliance between this older and this newer part of the brain. So anxiety, basically, if we let's unpick it a bit more, this experience. We talk about solvable anxiety or free-floating anxiety. Solvable anxiety is the sort of everyday response to, I get here, discover that I haven't got my little connector here, we've got 2 minutes to which we kick off, everybody's waiting to start the recording, it's all very anxious, so I have to go looking for one and come back, but now it's solved, so we're all happy. And that's, you know, classic. But then there's something called free-floating anxiety, which in many ways, free-floating anxiety is being driven by the forward-looking parts of the brain, which are saying, you know, that happened in the past, what might happen in the future? And free-floating anxiety is about threat management by cognitive activity. Worrying is trying to manage threats by anticipating all the possible ways and the directions from which they might come. So you worry, and you think that if I can just line them up in my mind, all the possible ways in which threat comes, then at least I'll be ready, you see. And so you get 7 or 8 sources of threat, but hey, there might be more, that needs to keep thinking. And so worry is based in the cognitive forward-looking part of the brain that's trying to help us. And that's where the phenomenon of worry comes from. Then there's the subjective sense of fear, which is basically an emotion, and it's a painful emotion. And if it were a pleasurable emotion, it wouldn't be any use, would it? You know, if you're going through and a lion jumps out at you, and you've been having a pleasurable anticipation of that, you're no. So fear is it's a great servant of our safety. Increased vigilance and startle response we've talked about, and then because of adrenaline being released, we get a range of physical symptoms. And these are quite important just to take a moment to recap on. I know for many this is really basic stuff, but for others it's worth just thinking about the physical symptoms that adrenaline produces. Tachycardia is simply a racing heart. Palpitations are a thumping heart, we all know that. Chronic hyperventilation, though, is a real issue, because if we're in a state of free-floating anxiety and we've got higher adrenaline levels, and also another hormone called cortisol tends to get pumped out as we go into chronic anxiety. Chronic hyperventilation is a problem. It's partly, you can see why the body's saying, when you need to run, you use oxygen. So let's get plenty of oxygen in there. But actually, hyperventilation isn't good for us because it over-oxygenates the body. And when you over-oxygenate the body then has to compensate for too much oxygen. And one of the compensatory mechanisms is your arteries go into a spasm to reduce the amount of blood to the brain, because you're getting too much blood, you see. So your arteries go into spasm, they overcompensate, and people go and get a bit dizzy, which is another feature of chronic anxiety. Dry mouth and stomach churning are all features. And there are others too, you know, diarrhea, all ways in which we respond physically to anxiety. We'll skip that. So what we've done now is we've tried to map out the phenomenon of anxiety in human beings in simple terms. But let's now look at when doctors and when professionals start getting interested in it as a disorder. And you remember yesterday we said that there are no neat dividing lines between everyday stress and the difficulties of life that we all negotiate and when something becomes a disorder. And Richard mentioned the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, version 5, DSM-5, that's just been released. Don't be deceived by these manuals. They create a precision, they create an impression of precision. And precision creates an impression of professionalism and knowledge. And much of that is an illusion. It creates an impression that we know far more than we actually do. Here's an example. I think Richard said you've got to have had depression, one of the criteria, for 2 weeks, you see. So what about if you've had depression for 13 days? Are you not depressed yet? Now, how do we land on 2 weeks? Simply because you've got to, if I'm going to communicate with somebody, you've got to have a set of definitions that you both agreed on. It's no use my ringing up the hospital and say, I've got a man here who's got a major depressive illness in DSM-5 terms, and then I send someone who's been depressed for a couple of days. The whole point of these manuals is to create shorthand labels so that we can communicate quickly, you see. And so inevitably, you have to make what are called an operational diagnosis. You just agree on a set of symptoms, and you say, we'll all agree, you've got to have had it 2 weeks. And that sort of fits. It fits reality in a number of ways. You know, if you've had it 2 weeks, the likelihood is it is going to go on then after that. So there's sort of a fit with reality. But I often say to people, don't be. I was on what was called the internet. There are two big systems in the world for classifying disorders. One is the American one, DSM, and the other is the World Health Organization one, the ICD-10, as it is. And I sat on the ICD-10 committees, one of them, that basically define these disorders, you see. And basically, it's just a committee of people. And you'll have a little discussion about whether you need to have 5 symptoms or 6 symptoms. And it's just at the end of the day, let's take a vote on it. You know, just a bunch of people like me get on an aeroplane, go to Geneva, sit in a room, and create the best fit with our clinical experience. It's a bit more sophisticated than this, but that's at the end of the day, these are operational definitions. So don't be deceived by the precision. Americans love DSM-5 because it does validate professionals. It looks very clear, crisp, clean. Life's not like that. Everything is on a spectrum. You know, if one thing merges into another. So don't be deceived. DSM-5 is also driven by insurance companies in the States, because the first question they ask is what is the disorder, you see? So they can look it up in the book and they can attach an amount of money to the treatment, and that drives DSM. Anyway, that little sermon was about was life is muddier than these classifications suggest. And at the end of the day, a disorder is what a doctor says is a disorder. Seriously, which is what this cartoon is pretty much saying. He's crazy when I say he's crazy, and that's it. But the rules of thumb are that there is a characteristic syndrome or pattern that doctors recognise. So if I go to Geneva. We talk about depression. We can say, it's very interesting, it's the same where I am. You know, once someone's had it 2 weeks, there really is something going on that people want to, respond to. And so there is a pattern there that's recognisable. It's also that something that's severe in terms of suffering to the person and an impairment of the life. And also, it's not something that's just been there for a day or two. There is a duration crisis. You know, something that's been around enough to cause a problem. So do you remember those are the criteria for disorder? So I'm going to share with you, I think, 4 anxiety-related disorders. The first one is what's called in the DSM-5, generalized anxiety disorder. And at any one time, 15% of adults will meet criteria for this. So it's quite a common, quite a prevalent disorder. If you include the full range of cases, from mild to severe. Did I say 15%? 5%, sorry. you always know something's wrong when people in the audience start looking. 5%. I can only say, excuse my call, that's what's making me a little cognitively impaired. You know, 5%. So here are the symptoms of generalized anxiety disorder. First of all, a duration criteria of 6 months. So you really need to have had it for quite a while. There's free-floating anxiety, fear, increased vigilance, this on-edge irritability, distractibility that we've talked about, adrenaline-related physical symptoms, and cognitive problem-solving that we call worry, or cognitive round of attempted problem-solving that we call worry. So we've got this cluster of symptoms, a duration, a severity criteria, which is that it's got to be extremely stressful, upsetting, and uncontrollable, and then you've got an impairment criteria that this really is disrupting your life. So doctors get interested at this point, you know, when you've got this cluster of symptoms. And that's basically generalized anxiety disorder. That's the first picture that we see. The next picture is this one, panic disorder. And this is about 1% of adults, and 10% have some mild, now this is quite high, this is 10%, have some mild panickiness from time to time. But panic disorder is about 1%. And what does this look like? This isn't a constant background, free-floating sense of anxiety. This is an episodic rush of anxiety symptoms that embraces both psychological and physical features. You know when you've got panic disorder. It is an intensely painful experience. It is a rush of anxiety-related symptoms. And this is characterized by an overwhelming sense of fear and anxiety, to the point that many people feel they are going to die. This is so awful. I am going to die. Just terrible. It has a full house nearly of acute adrenaline-related physical symptoms. All the ones we talked about here, you know, generalized anxiety disorder, and trembling, sweating, and often chest pain. The reason chest pain is because of the palpitations that are often a significant feature of panic disorder. And the palpitations, once you focus on a physical disorder, the worry turns it into a painful emotion. And of course, that means that people often think they're having a heart attack. And if you think you're having a heart attack, how does that make you feel? Frightened, which makes you more frightened now, which makes your heart go faster. Okay, and similarly, the body responds in a it fires off in all directions to try and control this. So you start hyperventilating, get oxygen in case you need to run. This situation is so uncontrollable, so overwhelming. Let's get more oxygen because we just need to run. And so you start hyperventilating. Hyperventilating, as we said earlier, isn't good for the body. The body, too much oxygen isn't good. So you can then get some arterial spasm that lead in the arteries that supply the brain, which then makes you feel lightheaded, which confirms your fear that you are dying. You know, you're actually losing consciousness. Or the other thing that happens is because of the too much oxygen, you get a shift of calcium around the nerves in the body. And you don't need to know why, but you just get this shift of calcium. And then the nerves don't work properly and you get tingling in your fingers. And now I'm hyperventilating, I'm feeling slightly dizzy, my heart's racing, and now my fingers are beginning to tingle. And if it gets really bad, I go into what's called carpopedal spasm, where the nerves send my muscles into spasm like this. And this is the classical sign, you see. This is so easily, the whole syndrome is so easily treated with a paper bag in the mouth, okay? But I'll come back to that, not in the mouth, on the mouth, sorry. I'll come back to this in a minute. panic disorder is really interesting as a phenomenon of a circularity, because what happens is somebody has anxiety symptoms. So, you know, you're sitting an exam, someone, your child maybe has an illness and you're not sure, the doctors seem worried, and or your marriage is really getting very problematic, your husband may leave you, and you know, a number of sources of anxiety, and you get a generalized anxiety pattern of symptoms. But palpitation becomes a particularly worry for you. And the palpitations may then escalate into a full-blown panic attack. The panic attack produces a whole range of anticipatory cognitions, which is, this may happen again. Now, if you think to yourself, this may happen again, you start pumping out adrenaline. And then your heart starts racing faster, and then you start to say, I have got, panic. So I have got this heart problem, which produces more adrenaline, and round it goes. And that's how people, get caught up in an acute panic attack. And so what? How do we help this? Well, the easy and quick thing to do is to breathe into a paper bag, because that gets carbon dioxide back into the body, it reduces the oxygen. The oxygen then, you don't need to go in spasm here, you begin to feel less lightheaded, the tingling goes away. At the same time, you say, you'll be fine in a minute, just breathe into this bag. You talk the person down, and then you get into a virtuous circle rather than a vicious circle, which you say, you watch, the symptoms will go down in a minute, and then you can begin to tell yourself that this isn't something that's going to kill you, you're not having a panic attack. Look, feeling better already. And so then you get into a virtuous circle. It's really easy to treat in the acute phase. In the more, once you've treated the acute panic attack, you then need to work on the anticipatory cognitions, because it's the anticipatory cognitions that produce the symptoms that then escalate into a panic attack. And what you do is, it's simple cognitions like, when my heart starts to beat fast, I'm now beginning to understand I'm not having a panic attack. This is, as the doctor told me, a symptom of too much adrenaline. And I'm just producing too much adrenaline because of my ongoing anxiety. And so you replace the cognition, I am going to die, with, this is my adrenaline-related symptom. And I'm beginning to understand that. And again, it's a really nice thing to treat this, because it gives people a sense they regain control. Once they understand this range of symptoms, it really gives them a sense of regaining control, and you get them into a virtuous circle. So before, my heart begins to go faster, I thought, I'm going to have a panic attack. Now I think, I've learned so much about anxiety, and this is one of those adrenaline symptoms. And as that doctor told me, I just need to sit down, just breathe slowly, and it'll go away. And that's what happened last time, the time before, and the time before that. And that's what's going to happen this time. You see, so you're in this virtuous circle. And it's a really nice thing to do, because it builds confidence and helps the person regain control. And that opens them up then to talk about some of the factors that may be driving the anxiety in the first place. It's a great way of developing trust in you too, because it's very impressive when you help them in this way, and they feel so much better. But this is such a common thing. A common scenario is, I've seen this one. Your pastor is under a huge amount of strain and stress. He's got an important elders meeting where there are going to be some awkward people that night. There's a big issue bubbling up, and he just starts to panic, and his heart starts going, and he starts decompensating, and he's taken to the hospital, and everyone at church has told the pastor that he's got heart problems. We're worried. He's having lots of investigations. And what happens then is, he has lots of investigations. The doctor says there is nothing physically wrong with you, and the pastor's off for 3 months or so, with really anxiety. But of course, the problem is, there's a great investment because of the shame around this, that we focus on those physical symptoms. In Christian circles, we nearly need those physical symptoms as our ticket out of shame, don't we? And so you may find that the pastor hangs on to his heart ticket for quite a while, or your Christian brother or sister. It's that, you know, it's better to have worry about a heart problem than people think you're cracking up, isn't it? Who wants your pastor to crack up? In fact, I met a guy recently, and I'd say he just had a moderate depression. He needed 3 or 4 weeks off work. A really competent pastor. And he opened his heart. People, he said, you know, it's been a period of stress, and I do need to have this 3-4 weeks off. Is that okay? And they convened a church meeting and sacked him. You know, and that is a reality behind, you know, behind the fear of the shame issue, that many of our churches just don't understand this. So one of the advantages of teaching your people, we were talking earlier about, you know, how in our preaching we need to, it's about preaching is pastoring the heart, isn't it, from the pulpit. And one of the payoffs of teaching your people about these things is when you get it, maybe they won't sack you, you know, maybe they'll be a little more appreciative that you've helped them. But you know, you grow a culture of appreciation in your congregation that we're broken in different ways and we need to be relationally alongside one another. Anyway, I mention that because I've seen this a few times in pastors, panic attacks and worry that you've got a heart problem. Then you've got phobic disorders, and including mild phobias. You know, lots of people have mild phobias. Up to 15% of people will be able to describe something that provokes intense fear in them. This is an overwhelming need to avoid a source of anxiety. And so anxiety is allayed as long as I avoid the source of it. And there are two types, simple phobia and complex phobia. Simple phobias are specific to particular objects. Spiders, you know, is a common one. Complex phobias are fear of particular situations that are more complex, like shopping malls or crowds. Or social phobia is a complex phobia in which I'm phobic of being the subject of scrutiny socially. Those are the two types of phobia. So, if you think about some of these prevalence rates, if you're looking out across your congregation, there are going to be people with phobias. There'll be one or two with panic attacks. There'll be quite a few with this chronic tension, generalized anxiety disorder. Another one is post-traumatic stress disorder. And there's been lots of interest in this recently, hasn't there? Because this is a syndrome that follows acutely stressful and threatening situations. Of a disproportionate nature, you know, a terrifying nature where there is real threat to life and limb. And this military combat, terrorist attacks, natural disasters, witnessing very violent incidents, violent personal assaults, road traffic accidents. And about, you know, within about 1 month, people involved in these things, up to about 30% will describe the following pattern of symptoms. And here it is. Post-traumatic stress disorder, reliving experiences are at the heart of this syndrome. So it's a reenacting what you've gone through. And it's usually in the form of what are called flashbacks, which are acute visual or mental reliving of that incident. And you have a response in your own self, which is which mirrors how you felt at the time. So it is as if you're going through it, as if you're seeing it, or as if you're you know, feeling those feelings all over again. There's a lot of misunderstanding about flashbacks. I've seen an awful lot of these people over the years. And there's a big industry now around car accidents, whereby if you have a car accident, solicitors will try to get your money by getting you to sue the insurance company for post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's quite common now to send people who've been in accidents a little checklist. Do you have flashbacks? Tick. Is your sleep impaired? Tick, you see. And you know, money, we all like to get a 5,000 quid, you know, flashbacks. Yeah, you know, those memories are pretty painful that I have of that incident. And you know, my sleep's, you know, not quite what it was. And before you know where you are, you're seeing a specialist to see whether you've got the diagnosis. And I saw quite a few of these cases, and I just wasn't convinced. You know, there are lots of people, what they call flashbacks are simply memories. They've just got a slightly unpleasant memory. They've not got this acute reliving that we're really talking about here. This is a painful characteristic feature, and you should discriminate from just a painful memory of what happened. The point is, too, that it's a flashback because it's resisted. You're not courting, you're not seeking this experience. It flashes into your mind, unsolicited, unwanted, and actually resisted. Often associated with a sort of free-floating guilt feeling. And then, because this is an unwanted experience, it's associated with avoiding anything that cues the original memory. So if the accident happened at a certain crossroads, I've seen lots of people will drive around another part of the town to avoid that area, because when they go to the area, it cues their memory, which provokes a flashback, and they just don't want to think about it. So you do have this emotional numbing as well, which links to this, because what's happening is the person is closing down. This is such an emotionally disturbing experience. They close down emotionally to try and distance themselves from it. So avoiding the crossroads is about putting physical distance between myself and that memory. Emotional numbing is putting emotional, subjective distance between myself by closing down my sense of emotional responsiveness. So the hibernation, closing in. But of course, the brain at its more primitive level is still trying to protect us. And it's really very concerned because this was a major incident and who knows what's going to happen next. So it ramps up arousal. And startle response is a common feature in PTSD. I've seen it so much, you know, people describe the door goes, someone bang, stop, and then you respond irritably, don't bang that door. And it makes the family life quite difficult because the person's so irritable, such a low tolerance of challenging events, and this startling response. Poor concentration, insomnia, depressed mood, and of course, attempts at self-medication just to, you know, to allay this, the alcohol. So that's the characteristic pattern of PTSD. Now, what I'm going to do now is look at some of the causes of all of these clusters of anxiety-related symptoms. And I'm going to look at the causes all together rather than taking them individually. Okay, and it's just the same as for depression. We think in terms of genetic / biological, that should say, and environmental. And where you get a combination of those two things, you get your affected people. So what does this look like here in anxiety-related problems? Well, here are the risk factors. Genetics, pretty weak, actually. Pretty weak. Genetics aren't a big factor in anxiety-related. There is a genetic predisposition, but it's not as strong as, say, for say the genetics of bipolar disorder. So it's fairly weak, but it's there. There's been a lot of work on imbalance in brain transmitters. Believe me, because anxiety is so common, think how much money you could make if you're a pharmaceutical company, if you could come up with something. And in the 60s, particularly the early 70s, we thought we had found something, and it was called Valium. Remember, you know, and the number of people who were put on Valium was incredible in those early days. what we found was, of course, it produces, it's enormously addictive, Valium, diazepam, and it's very rarely used now, except quite selectively. But think how much money you could make if you could find something for generalized anxiety disorder that was, you know, simple to use and relatively free of side effects and wasn't addictive. And so pharmaceutical companies have poured huge amounts of money into the biology of anxiety disorders and come up with very little that's concrete in terms of evidence. So I wouldn't worry too much about this area either, although there are, you know, there are lots of stories, but there isn't one story that's really leads one, you know, that's really a headline here. Abnormal hormone responses. There is a problem that one can prime these hormone systems in the sense that, you know, they become self-regulating and self-generating. So you get in the habit of putting out a lot of adrenaline, and the system just goes into, you primed it, it goes into an overdrive, and you're just producing adrenaline. And chronic cortisol probably isn't all that good for us. There's some emerging evidence that high levels of cortisol over many years may be associated with brain atrophy and decline. So there's a bit of a worry that chronic worriers, you know, may be putting their brains at risk by having pumped out so much cortisol over so many years. Changes in the brain at a... That are observable on brain imaging, that there is a bit of a story emerging here. And what's interesting is if you look at the limbic system and the hypothalamus, brain imaging studies are showing that there do seem to be long-term changes that are observable in the hypothalamus of people with chronic anxiety. And the worry is that you know, one has produced possibly a permanent change in which the activity levels in this area are disproportionate and excessive. So there's a lot more activity going on here. These are early days. You know, as with all these data, it depends on your samples, and the story doesn't quite hang together. But there's a lot of interest in possibly longer-term abnormalities in the hypothalamus being produced by chronic anxiety. And certainly that's the case in post-traumatic stress disorder. And we're even beginning to wonder whether early childhood abuse, anxious parenting, as well as trauma and adversity that produces PTSD, that whether they don't actually prime the brain in this way to be more anxious, responsive, chronically anxious. So again, this is early work, but that there is some emerging evidence that children who've suffered abuse may have this longer term hypothalamic overreactivity. But of course, current adversity is one of the key risk factors, threat loss. And then thinking styles, which we'll come on to in a moment, but thinking styles, which are, you know, cognitive therapists are hugely helpful in spotting anxiety generating thinking styles. Can any of you throw me one or two typical anxiety generating thinking styles? Yeah, so catastrophizing is, you know, one thing leads on to another, doesn't it, in life? You know, it's that kind of irrational thinking, but you can see how it had its origins in something that's potentially protective. As I said right at the beginning, a lion jumps out on you. Maybe a tiger, they look like lions. Maybe tigers are just as dangerous, or other animals. So it's grown out of something that is rational and protective, but it's got out of control to the extent that everything is now a threat. And you begin to anticipate that it's all going to go wrong. And catastrophizing is a really common cognitive dysfunction that people with anxiety have. And unpicking it can be really a revelation for people as you help them see how this thought process is causing so much fear and anxiety for them. Yes. Exactly, and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if you think one bad thing leads to the next, this is all going to spin out of control. I am going to end up in, lose my job, lose my home, my family will leave. You know, if you think all of those things, how does the body respond? You produce adrenaline. Adrenaline produces symptoms, which then confirm that you are spinning out of control. As we say, that's what makes panic disorder a nice model for what you can do, because you treat the short-term symptoms, but then you help the person understand how their thoughts actually do affect their body. Any other sort of anxiety-producing cognitions you can think of? Something called confirmation bias, which is, there's a lot of psychological work on this thing called confirmation bias, which is, at its simple level, you know, the disposition we have as fallen human beings to have known how things work out all along. Have you ever talked to someone and you say, and you share something with them and they say, quiet, yes, they knew that all along, you know. Of course, that's the other thing these people say, of course, yes, of course. And you thought you're sharing something really interesting, you know, of course, you know. And that's there in all our hearts in some ways. We want to be on the right side of the angel. We want to have known that. And a nice experiment, if you take a group of people like us and put that vase around the middle, put this half in a room next door, and I come in with a clipboard and a white coat, and I say, I'd like to just do one or two simple tests with you. The first is this. Experimental psychologists have shown conclusively that when people create relationships, similar personality types tend to be drawn to one another, which confirms that old saying. What's the old saying? Birds of a feather flock together. You say, now how could you just, if you already knew that, could you just tick, you see? You discover that the vast majority of people, oh, then we all knew that, birds of a feather flock together, you know, and there's no surprise there. But if we take this half and we put you in the room next door and I come in and say, modern experimental psychology has shown that in relational pairing, opposite personality types, once you've classified personality, tend to go together, which all goes to share that old saying, opposites attract. How many people knew that? You would all have known that as well, you see. So that confirmation bias is a powerful feature of fallen mental life, in which we want our fantasies, our own view of the world, to have been true. And so we filter into our understanding of the world those things we want to see and that confirm our own biases. And that can work in an anxiety-provoking way. Once you become anxious, you see the fulfillment of your most frightening prophecies, you know, and that then can add to catastrophizing on you go. Other cognitions, they'll get you in the end, is another one. Or they're all out to, it links with paranoid ideation, you know, they're all out to get you. All of them. They'll all get you in the end, you know. That's another, and you'd be surprised how something like that is just under the surface of many people's thinking. And it's helpful to, in cognitive therapy, to bring it out and say, let's challenge that now objectively and look at what truth there is in that. It can be unfortunate when it turns out it is pretty true in someone's life and they are all out to get you and the congregation does want to vote you out and so on, you know. So it's about bringing rationality to the situation. Okay, so what are the common psychiatric and psychological approaches to these kinds of syndromes, these four syndromes? Medication. Doctors love medication, you see. There are basically three types that are used. There are anxiolytics, which are like diazepam, and they're still used, some of these, but they're used in the short term. And really, it's a sewable thing if a doctor leaves you on anxiolytics long term, because they're so addictive. And so doctors tend now to be quite twitchy about, certainly in England, about prescribing anxiolytics. And but let's keep a proportion. You know, if someone is very, very anxious and incapacitated, it can be, you know, it can be a reasonable thing to do to give them a very short course of an anxiolytic treatment. Antidepressants are also anxiolytic on in general. Not all, but some are really quite anxiolytic, like diazepam. And the advantage of antidepressants is they're much less addictive, so you can use them for a little longer. And then beta blockers. What beta blockers do is they block the effects of adrenaline. So if someone's having a racing heart, put them on a beta blocker and that'll help slow it. All of this is elastoplast, isn't it? It's just putting elastoplast on the surface of the wound. But there can be tools that are useful. For example, if you put someone on beta blockers, you can use that to educate them, to show how when their heart goes slower, you know, that really does demonstrate this is an adrenaline-related thing. We can slow the heart with this medication. You know, you could do the same. You could have the same effect as taking the beta blockers by thinking differently, because the adrenaline is being produced by your thoughts. So generally, medication, there's a place for it, but I would say it's a small place, a limited, targeted role. And it's certainly not the top of the list. I mean, I've done it first because many doctors think this way, but in the anxiety disorder, I think medication plays a generally smaller role. General management's quite important. I think confidence is infectious. You know, if the person you're seeing feels that you've seen this before, that's hugely reassuring, just to be able to convey to them that, you know, this is something you understand and recognize. And, you know, support them in their pain, to stand alongside them, to empathize with the symptoms. It's really helpful when people, you know, say, so do you ever get your heart races? And so, yeah, you know, and they're quite pleased. You knew that. So you have some knowledge of this. That's very reassuring. What about you? Tell me, does that sometimes churn? Yeah, I get that. Some people get a bit sweaty, and so on. So, at the end here, I've referenced some leaflets that you can download from the Royal College of Psychiatrists site, which really summarise much of what I'm saying, and that are very useful, and even some in Polish there, so it's quite helpful. Education is so important, you see. And it can be so rewarding to just take people through these symptoms in a way that I've described. Sleep hygiene, just getting into a regular pattern, as we said yesterday, not taking caffeine, not watching very stimulating things on television, and so on. Okay, so there's those two approaches, but this is the really key bit, is getting a good assessment before we go any further. An assessment involves hearing their story, working out really how severe this is and how it's affecting their lives. That takes time. And the next question, after you've worked out the story and you've attended to severity and impairment, is there a critical point of intervention here? In two areas. First is the management of the presenting symptoms, and then the management of the underlying issues. What I'm saying is, you've got to make a decision. What's the critical point of intervention in terms of the presenting symptoms? And it varies from person to person. Some people, the critical point of intervention is they just want you to hear them and understand them. And that can be hugely reassuring. And you don't need to do much more than that. That's been the critical factor for them, and that you've agreed to see them again. So, you know, support can be the critical thing to do, and listening and understanding in the short term. Medication may, as we've said, in someone who's very uncontrollable, very pained, out of control, may be indicated. And spotting cognitive errors as a short-term measure an intervention can also be very good. So, for example, teaching someone catastrophization is a nice little technique in the early phases, because it can make sense to people in a way which opens them up then to explore other areas. So, you know, helping people spot these cognitive errors. Once you've got some purchase on the presenting symptoms, you can then go into the underlying issues. And the underlying issues can be explored in terms of interpersonal relationship issues, or it can be explored in a more cognitive framework in terms of long-term thinking habits which are maladaptive or anxiety generating for this person. The question is, would adoption be one of these sort of adverse early events? And the answer to that is, you know, is no in any general sense. You know, adoption, you can't say adoption causes this, but there are always circumstances around events which may, you know, produce longer term anxiety related things. So adoption itself isn't the issue. It may be, you know, how the adoption was handled, how the person sees it, how the process of discovering you're adopted, or how that's handled by the parents. You know, it's the context of the adoption that matters rather than the adoption itself.
Yeah.
And as you know, attachment problems. So if you disrupt attachment, and what happens, a baby develops attachment to the mother or the primary caregiver between about 12 and 18 months. And there's a lot of quite nice work now following through children to show that, you know, being able to attach emotionally to the primary caregiver is important for subsequent psychological health and good relationships. It creates a security in the person, which enables them to make secure predictions about the world. Because as you're saying, If that key first relationship goes astray, there are all kinds of possible predictions that flow from that. You know, that the world's an insecure place. People show you love and then they disappear. It's highly unpredictable, the world. There's nothing secure about it. So you can see how it can generate anxiety. Everybody's different. All contexts are different. And there's, you know, one shouldn't take this possibility that there are longer term brain changes to create pessimism. Remember, the brain itself isn't fixed and solid. That you can work, you know, the brain itself can recover. And there isn't enough work on this at the moment. But what I can tell you is, we know enough about the brain for you not to allow these early findings, for you not to allow that to label a kid or to create disproportionate fear, particularly because someone's adopted. Maybe you say, now I understand what's happened. They're adopted, they've got the chronic brain changes, and that explains everything, so the outlook's pretty grim. You know, don't get drawn into that pessimism when you see brain changes. There's still lots to play for. I think Richard made the point earlier, you know, that the brain changes both ways, for work, for ill, and for better. And we talked about renewing our brains. So there's lots one can do to rebuild. But there's no doubt about it, attachment losses and attachment disruption does and can create some real long-term issues for people that you've just got to work with and